Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming, or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you are listening to today's interview and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details or contact us at pr@speakuptalkradio.com. Right now, I have a fascinating science fiction author with me. He is Ray Perot. Ray was born in New Hampshire, received his Bachelor's of Science in Aeronautical Engineering from Arizona State University, and later a Master of Science in Technical Management. Now retired from an influential multi-decade career in aerospace and wanting to bring a new voice to science fiction writing, Ray realized there was a niche that was calling him as he began to write deeper characters, create more sophisticated stories, and realistic situations for sci-fi fans to relate to. Initially attracted to heroic characters with powerful weapons, taking on hundreds of aliens, Ray began his literary career with a desire to extrapolate sci-fi stories with a touch of everyday reality that most of us experience in our work and our everyday lives. Writing about the other guys in science fiction would fill an interesting void. His literary work is thoughtfully enriched by his decade-long experience in the U.S. Air Force, where he flew C-130s on missions to 27 countries, and T-38s while training the best pilots in the world, as well as the first female U.S. Air Force pilots. During his 28 years at Northrop Grumman, Ray worked on some of the most top-secret military aircraft projects in the world, including the F-23, F-35, B-2, Global Hawk, and many more that can't be named. He says he is grateful to his wife Charlene and his two daughters Christine and Robin for their support on this journey, and I am grateful to have this opportunity to share him with you. So welcome to the network, Ray.
Well, thank you, Pat. It's a pleasure talking with you and talking about science fiction.
Well, there we go. You have quite a past. So I'm imagining there's a story or a reason why you came to write science fiction. What attracted you?
Well, I've always been a storyteller, and I like technology. And I've read a lot of the classic science fiction. And I enjoyed how science fiction can be used to reflect human nature and society, politics, a lot of issues that are near-term or near and dear to all of us. So I enjoyed the marriage of all of those issues together. And when I retired, my wife kept hampering me or harping me to write. And eventually I just started. Now I just can't seem to stop.
Once you got rolling,
yes.
this is your calling. Did you find it difficult to go from writing technical information, say, in your previous career, to something that will now keep the reader engaged? Was that a jump for you?
Amazingly difficult. Mm-hmm. I wrote a great deal when I was at Northrop, probably millions of words, you know, all kinds of technical documents. And the first couple copies of my manuscript that were sent out for review, I had one professor of literature who reviewed it for me, and she was honest. She came back and said I had the most bizarre writing style she had ever encountered. So I figured from that starting point, I could only improve.
Oh, my gosh. Well, at least you stood out to her, right?
Yes.
So what are some of the challenges, then, when writing in this genre?
Well, there's a lot of challenges. Writing is the easy part. The marketing, sales, promotion is the difficult part. But I would just as soon sit down and write 8 hours a day. But I have to get diverted to, you know, get some money so that I can pay for the advertising and the marketing. But the writing is not the challenge. I'm a great storyteller. I love to just sit down and just tell a story.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you are quite a prolific author. How many books have you written?
Well, I've written so far in about 3 years. I've written, I think, 7 or 8 novels and 4 short stories. And I have currently 2 new novels in the work, which I hope to have out by the summer. And I've got 2 outlines for short stories also in the work. So I'm hoping this will be a busy year.
Well, it sounds like it. And so where do you get this inspiration?
Well, I like looking at current science fiction stories or even real life. And a lot of times you can look at, like, corporate intrigue or politics or society as a whole and say, that would be an interesting science fiction story. I like to focus on the other guy in science fiction. So For example, one of my main characters is an evil computer. I've read so many stories where people always talk about evil and the evil computer attacks or the mechanized society attacks. And I've often wondered, well, no one's written about the evil computer. So he's a main character in one of my series. And as I jokingly say that if aliens ever attack Earth, I'll probably be writing about the aliens.
Interesting. Well, so you've kind of taken a different perspective, and I'm going to cover that in a little bit. But first, maybe give us a synopsis of your most recent book so we can get a feel for how you write and what you write about.
Well, my main series is probably going to be a seven-part or seven-novel series, and I've already got four that are released, and I have three in various stages of outline, proofing, you know, alpha, beta versions. And the main crux of it is a future Earth or near-term Earth where we are attacked by a very suspicious virus. And through the first book, I deal with just the collapse of society, how the government and military deals with the virus's impact. And towards the end of the book, I start bringing in other characters, people on the space station Oasis, astronauts on the moon, and astronauts on Mars. And then the astronauts on the space station deal with it, and they're forced to come back to Earth. And in each subsequent novel, I continue that story. The second book is where they deal with society collapsing, and then they finally find out the source of the virus. And then that story has legs on into the future, because obviously being a science fiction writer, aliens have some involvement here without giving up the ghost, but aliens have some involvement. And so the story takes mankind from almost being wiped out to a couple of major events and epochs where they eventually end up being, you know, galactic travelers and interacting with societies around them. So it's a large story, and there are many paths through it, many characters, and that's the main crux of that. I have other series which are totally different. In fact, a lot of my readers enjoy my writing because I do write differently. I don't follow a formula and just keep cranking books out. Each of my books has different heroes, different antagonists, but they are part of a larger story. But I do have other series, one that is totally aliens. It's about a young couple of aliens on a planet that is made up of naive aliens, and they're attacked, and they do battles for survival. And the whole, you know, I developed the whole society, the religion, the agriculture, the politics. And that's going to have some follow-on work to it also. And then I just finished a book recently where I took two of my short stories and expanded them into an interesting future human story where we have a different approach towards evil, and we have a different definition of the antagonist and protagonist. And that's fun to play with because I really like exploring evil and leadership. I think those are key elements that a lot of science fiction stories lack. You know, they have boilerplate evil, or they have boilerplate heroes that, you know, have superpowers and go out and, you know, defend the world. I really enjoy getting into what leadership is and how my strong women or female leaders interact as real leaders, and not just because they have superpowers and the male leaders, you know, make mistakes. They screw up sometimes. And I also like having an evil in one book become a protagonist, another book, because evil isn't always that simple.
Let's explore the evil aspect about it, because in real life, evil is kind of a matter of perspective, as you have said, and that it's sometimes the good guys are evil, and that the evil might turn out not to be totally evil. So that's an interesting thing to play with.
Exactly. And in my book, Progeny's Children, the evil people are the ones you at least suspect.
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoyed developing that, and I'm going to keep playing with that theme, again, because evil is not always cut and dry. And a lot of times, evil is where a leader has had lousy choices, and he has to make the least worst decision. Mm-hmm. But to a lot of people, he appears evil. So I like adding complexity to that dimension.
Very, very interesting. You don't find that very often in the science fiction books.
Well, that's why I'm trying to play in that, because I've had a lot of experience in leadership and management, and I've seen both sides of complex decision-making. So I know intimately how evil can be perceived from one group of people and then totally different from another group.
Yeah, and you talk about how typical sci-fi depicts women leaders with stereotypical leadership skills and that the men are all overpowering and all empowered, but you're changing that paradigm.
Well, I'm trying to because, as it said in my bio, I was fortunate. I was an instructor pilot for the first group of Air Force female pilots. And I was really impressed with the women that I flew with. They were all excellent pilots, but they approached stress totally different than a man does. There is no right or wrong way to deal with stress as long as the outcome is accomplishing the goals you want to. So they dealt with it much differently. So I really appreciated their different approach. In one of my books, I talk about, I have a computer society, and they talk about the need to have a male and female-oriented computer because they realized that the strength of the whole was enhanced by having two approaches to solving problems. So they made a conscious decision to create a male-type mind and a female-type mind so that they would both contribute to the solution.
Very interesting. And that's also interesting in times, especially now when everyone's so concerned about everybody has to be completely equal, everything is equal. But as you said, as you were training these pilots, they were equal as far as their ability, but how they approached situations were different.
Yes, very much so. I had one young woman who swore like a truck driver. She was the sweetest thing, very pleasant person, very intelligent, excellent pilot, but she would swear when she was flying. And I had another woman who you could hear the stress in her voice. She was on the verge of breaking down, but by God, she flew the airplane. She was a hell of a pilot. She did what was required of her, and she vented her stress that way. Now,
Interesting.
some guys flying will become quiet. And then they become unpredictable, or some guys will be angry and aggressive. So everybody has different ways to deal with stress. And I just found that it was interesting to see how these young women dealt with stress in a very stressful environment. And since then, I've been fortunate. I had two daughters, and I worked hard to bring them up so that they could deal with stress and deal with logical analysis. Being an engineer, I tend to go that way. So I've tried to mold that experience into my writing so that my female leaders are flawed, but yet honest and trying to do the right job. And as most good leaders, they tend to do the right thing slightly more than not. Nobody's perfect. Nobody makes all the right decisions, but a good leader recognizes when they make the wrong mistake and they change direction.
Now, do your readers get back to you? Do you hear from them where they really appreciate that you are delving into something a little bit different?
A lot of them do, and a lot of them come back and with suggestions about other plot lines, which I wish I could follow, but obviously I can't write that much. But most of my readers right now, the last demographics I saw were about 60% women, which had surprised me. But I write men characters that are real, and I write women characters that are real. I don't have anybody with psychic powers solving all the problems or, superhuman strength. I just have real aliens or people solving real problems in a sci-fi environment.
Now, in your Simpoc book, that's the book about the computer.
Well, Simpoc actually started off, I wrote two novellas from the computer's perspective. Simpoc was the first intelligent computer created in 2051, and then that was coincidentally the time that the virus struck. And then those two books developed the story from their perspective, from the computer's perspective. So there's a lot of computer dialogue, and I bring in supporting characters. And the second book in that series was more about the evil computer, how it emerged in a society where the programmers didn't come back to work, and these two highly sophisticated computers were let loose. And a lot of my readers came back and said, hey, the backstory is just as interesting, the president and the astronauts and society. So I took those two novellas and expanded them into Virus 1 and 2. I expanded them like five times. So I took all of the backstory, and the main characters in the virus series are, the president, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the female commander of the space station Oasis, her husband, and then a supporting character in that story is Simpoc. And one of the arch enemies becomes that evil computer. And that antagonism between society and these two strong computers continues throughout that series.
How was that for you to write from that perspective, not of a human perspective?
Well, I started off getting too much into it. I've got a lot of computer experience and systems experience at large corporate levels. So I try to translate logical decision-making into dialogue, which was very challenging. Mm-hmm. And I went through it a number of times. But I've had a lot of people comment that they enjoyed it and they can relate to how the computer's dialogue works in the story because I backed it off a lot. Mm-hmm. And I've just woven through the story logical statements or observations that the computer would make. I try not to get into the details too much. But it's obvious that it's a computer thinking and analyzing things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my readers really enjoyed that. And I've had a lot of computer experts, you know, very senior level computer experts come back and say that how I depicted it was very accurate and very realistic when it comes to computer logic.
Wow. You'd be the only person that would be able to write like this, just pulling in from your background.
Well, I'm fortunate because my career has covered a lot of ground.
Right.
In the Air Force, I flew amazing airplanes, traveled around the world, had marvelous experiences, and then I had almost 30 years in aerospace. And to be honest, I went up and down the org chart a couple times. You know, if what I was working on was popular at the moment, I would end up, you know, being very influential within a division. And then when the powers changed, I would be sort of persona non grata. So I've had a lot of experience, and I've always been a people observer. I love to sit back and look at people and society dynamics. So it was real natural to roll all that together, along with my technical expertise, into sci-fi. And sci-fi was a natural place for that genesis to occur.
Well, hats off to your wife who insisted that you do this, right?
Well, I appreciate the fact that now she's having to deal with the fact that I don't take the trash out anymore.
Say, hey, you made me do it. Well, now you've written so many books and short stories. Do you have a favorite?
The story I'm working on today.
Mm-hmm.
I get into my stories, and it's really fun because, and other authors share this opinion, where you don't really know how it's ending until you get there. Often in my books, I start typing faster and faster at the end of the book because I don't know how the pieces are coming together yet. And I reach the ending at about the same point the reader does. And I find that really exhilarating because it's not like I have a formula. And, on this page, I'm going to kill this person. On this page, this is going to occur. I don't know. I just have all the storylines in my head. And as I'm rolling towards the conclusion of the book, I just start drawing them in as I need to build a unique ending for that story. And I find that really exhilarating. I enjoy that a lot.
Absolutely. I can understand that. So is there any outlining that goes on, or is this just kind of happening in your head?
Well, the outlining comes and goes. Sometimes I just start writing. And when I reach an impasse, then I start outlining. Other times I will go and outline the entire book at some level. Like I think one of my last books, I had like 20 pages of outline. Only because there are a lot of characters and a lot of events. So I had to make sure that the events were timed. I think that was my third book in the series because I have naval battles and Air Force battles and alien invasions and, you know, all kinds of parallel paths. So I had to make sure that I sequenced everything so that they each reached the climax at the right time. And I didn't forget somebody, you know, on a ship in the middle of the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also sounds like you've got the kind of thought process where you can be working on more than one story at the same time.
Yes. Right now I have two novels in work, and as I said, I have two short stories that I'm playing in my mind with. And often what happens, I'll write, and then I'll get to an impasse, and I'll just take a break and jump on a short story.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that kind of gives you a little mental break or refreshes you so you can get back to the previous one.
Yes, and usually when I'm writing, there's part of my brain that's saying, hey, wouldn't it be neat to throw this into the other story? So I'll jump back and put a couple of lines in an outline just so I'll pick it up. For example, I'm writing an interesting story that I'm really excited about, but it's going to take a lot of work yet. It's called Fermi's pair of socks. I don't know if you're familiar with Fermi's paradox or not, but Fermi was a nuclear physicist back during the development of the Manhattan Project. And he rhetorically was asking or pointing out to his contemporaries, if there are so many billions of planets out there and suns and likely places for people or intelligent societies to live, why haven't we seen evidence of them? So that evolved into Fermi's paradox. So what I'm writing is a youth-oriented science fiction novel called Fermi's Pair of Socks, play on the words, where some teenagers get involved on a journey, and they touch on each of the key elements of Fermi's paradox, and they learn from that journey. And that's going to be a fun story, but it's interesting because I'm having to develop about 8 unique alien societies at various points in their technical development. So that's taking some challenge. And I just came up with a neat one the other day, in fact, where I have these sort of amorphous blobs like giant octopuses, and I'm trying to think of how to develop their society on a water planet. So.
Do you ever sleep?
On occasion.
Very exciting to be you. There's so much.
Sometimes my editor probably thinks that I sleep when I'm writing, but
I doubt that. And you're also winning awards, and you're working on sound effects that are reminiscent to radio drama. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I was fortunate. I won the 2016 Summer eBook of the Year Award for Apple Literary. That was on the first book in the series, Virus: 72 Hours to Live. And I'm working with a number of excellent narrators. I've been fortunate. I'm working with one, a local, it's called Allport Studios, which just won the 2017 LA Film Festival Award for Best Documentary Short, which is about as big an award as you can make. Last year, Ron Howard won that award, so this year, the studio that I'm working with won it. So I'm excited about that. But the dramatized version is the second book in the Virus series, and it's being done by Soundware Studios in Maryland. And it's going to be a full dramatized version where there's all kinds of sound effects, computer noises, comm traffic. You know, you can hear the sounds of people walking on Mars, and he's also creating original music. And I'm really excited about it because this hasn't been done much. When you look up dramatized novels on the Internet, there are some, like somebody has done the Bible dramatized, and some of the classics have been done, like I think Isaac Asimov's The Foundation was done. But as far as a retail novel, new on the market, available for sale, there's very few out there. So we're really excited about it. But it is taking a great deal of work, and George Napier, the man who is doing it, is putting a great deal of effort into it. So we really hope that it's a success.
And that is the music that we played at the top of the show.
Okay. And it's also one I think we have a clip of.
Yes.
And if I can set the scene up a little bit. As I said, there's going to be 7 books in this series. This is the second book. Earth has already been attacked by the virus, and society has collapsed. And the space station Oasis, which is the link between Earth and the Moon and Mars colonies, has collapsed. And the crew has had to take lifeboats back to Earth. So Mars is facing absolute isolation. And that's, and this story is just a day in the lives of those Mars astronauts and the realization that they are now alone.
All right, we're going to take a moment and play that little clip for us right now.
Okay.
Red Dirt Mining, Field D4, Mars.
Willie, are you having any trouble?
Ophelia asked the last person in the group. They had walked almost 4 miles now on the Mars surface and were getting close to the habitats. The regolith was loose and rocky, and they had to take their time. If one of them fell, the others could help them up. If that happened, it was risky because the Mars dust seemed to get into everything, and falling in it always seemed to cause system problems.
Nope, I'm fine. Just taking my time.
Ophelia stood at the top of the rise as her crew members walked by on their way to the habitat. She checked each of them out as they crested the hill, and she saw a group that made her proud. After the walk, they looked like a group of very dirty people in what used to be white suits. The Mars dirt made a pretty picture on their suits. The helmets were clean, and as an observer looked lower, the white turned to pink, then orange, and finally ended in a bright set of boots. After the last person passed, she paused and looked at the Mars colony. She was in charge, and all of the people there were her responsibility. The habitat had 20 units, and when she got the next supply ship, she would be able to make two more units. Each of the living space habitats housed up to 4 crew members. There were also 5 nurseries below the surface, where the food production occurred. Acres of Martian surface were covered with a clear vinyl roof, with gardens below the surface. The surface was even with the Martian surface to reduce the impacts of the high winds. The CO2 and water came from the Martian environment, and mobile units worked in the confined spaces, harvesting the various crops. From her vantage point, she couldn't see the underground tunnels. When the colony first started, the tunnels were an important luxury, but it took years for them to be constructed and reinforced. As she stood there and watched her crew make their way down the slope, she saw a mining vehicle moving toward the maintenance cleaning pad. She could make out 6 mobile units waiting, and when the mobile unit arrived, they would clean the mobile miners before they would be let in for maintenance. There was a storm forecasted in the next few hours, so they were battening down the hatches. The world she knew was changing. The Earth was in trouble, Oasis was in trouble, and in turn, they were in trouble. No one could predict the future, but the future for her and her colony was bleak. She had a sudden urge to drag her husband Isaac off somewhere with a bottle of wine and just forget Mars. Joy turned and waved at her and said,
"Hey, get your butt going. Are you going to stay up there all day?"
She waved back and started down the slope. By then, 2 of her team were already on the cleanup pad getting their suits cleaned before entering the airlock.
Well, that's really beautiful music, isn't it?
I think so. He does an excellent job. He's got a number of other pieces out that are available on his website, but he's done a number of pieces. And also Chris Allport, the guy out of Allport Studios, has just released a couple of songs. And he's a major composer here in Southern California. So he's going to probably throw some music in on the next book he does. I'm looking forward to that.
Wow, what an exciting collaboration.
I enjoy it. I enjoy working with creative people. Mm-hmm. I've always prided myself on working in a technical environment and being able to cause creativity to flourish, mm-hmm. because it's important. I believe in letting narrators contribute their creativity to the project as mm-hmm. much as possible. I let them decide how to pronounce names. I let them, in this case, decide on the sound effects. I only comment if it's drawing down the narrative, you know, if the sound effects are too loud mm-hmm. or, overpowering the dialogue a little bit. But I really want the narrator to feel like he's contributing his creativity to it, because a narrator puts a lot into a book, and it's a lot of work for a narrator. So I want to respect their contribution and give them as much free rein as I can.
As you have been writing, have you learned anything about yourself, say, that you didn't know that came out because of the writing of these books?
That's an interesting question. I don't think so. I've always been somewhat of an introvert, so I have looked at myself a lot, and I don't think I found any surprises, except that I hate marketing.
I just interviewed somebody earlier, and she was saying she loves marketing and promotion. I said, oh, well, I think you're in the minority, because most writers want to really just sit and write and not have to put that other hat on and stop what they're doing, because it's a full-time job to market and promote.
Well, I enjoy it when it's productive.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's not, it's like throwing mud against the wall. You just keep hoping something will stick.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand. I understand that. I think your audiobooks help with that. That give people an immediate way to hear and maybe interest them, and you've done quite a bit with audiobooks.
Yes, I expect probably 5 more of my books to be released this spring. I'm working with 5 additional narrators right now, And at that point, all of my work will be available on Audible. Audible is growing faster compared to print books and ebooks. So I think there's a real potential for that. And I wish that the market was bigger than it is, but it still has a lot of growth potential. And I'm excited about that opportunity.
Oh, I agree. With people rushing around and sitting in traffic and trains and planes, it gives them another way to assimilate all of this information. So I think it's only going to get bigger and better.
Yes.
Yeah. Before we head out, your book covers. Share your thought process on the design of your covers.
Well, book covers are, everybody said you've got to have a perfect book cover, but there's no specifics on how to achieve that. There's a certain vein where they tell you, go look at the other book covers and try and look like those. And then there's another vein of more independence. I think I'm more of the second. I've had some positive comments where people say, hey, your book covers are more modern. They're different. You know, they're not like the classic sci-fi book cover. So I don't know if I'm going down the right path or not. I've had a number of my covers done by professionals, and I've done some because I've got some graphic background experience also. So I haven't found the Rosetta Stone for success with them yet, but I think my book covers are good, but they are different. Each series is radically different, and most of the books within the series are radically different. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's the right path to follow or not, and I'm sort of wrestling with that issue right now, whether or not I want to give up and make my book covers more like the mainstream sci-fi book covers or stick with more of an artistic direction.
I'm going to personally vote for Route 2.
Okay. I'll make note of that.
Because I was attracted to the covers. I enjoyed looking at them. So.
Oh, that's good. I appreciate that comment.
Mm-hmm. We wandered around and got a little bit of a feel for you, and I know there's just so much more, but that's why people need to get a hold of your books. Is there anything we missed, then, that you would like to talk about today?
No, except well, buy e-books or Audible books.
Mm-hmm. And where can folks go then to learn more about you, and where can they purchase your books?
Well, my books are available on Amazon and through Audible, so all the books are there. I have given away a lot of books. I have a fairly large readers list, almost 3,000 people, so people are more than willing to, more than able to join up. And I share a lot in those reading lists. I have a group of people who I send the covers out to get comments, or if I have plot ideas, or if people have comments. So I have a group of people who enjoy the writing process, and I love getting feedback from them. So I separated my reading list into groups, and I try and focus my emails to whatever their interest is. But my main webpage is RayJayPerrault.com. That's my name, RayJayPerrault.com. And my email address is RayJayWriter@yahoo.com. I love getting email, and I try and respond to everybody. In fact, there's one woman I've been dealing with the last 4 days now. She's having problems downloading one of my ebooks. So I've been trying to work her through her computer issues so she can get a free copy of my book.
Oh, that's very kind. You have such a fresh perspective, and I know that those listening are going to really enjoy your book. So I encourage everyone to head over to Ray J. Perrault. Perrault, RayJayPerrault.com.
Yes.
Ray, what a wonderful opportunity to share you with our listeners today. Thank you so much.
Well, I really appreciate it, Pat, and I hope that everybody who listens enjoys it, and I love what you do. I've listened to a couple of the authors. In fact, as I mentioned, I have hooked up with one of your previous authors and trying to support him in doing a documentary, so that should be exciting.
Keep me posted on that.
I sure will.
Thank you.
Okay, Pat.